Welcome. This is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. I'm coming to you on the 7th of July 2012 here in Japan, the 6th of July 2012, where I'm joined on the line by Dr. James F. Tracy, an associate professor of media studies at Florida Atlantic University, and the owner of a blog called memorygap.org, where he writes on a wide range of subjects. So, Dr. Tracy, thank you for joining us on the program today. It's great to have you here.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to start today by talking about a very interesting and important article you wrote called The Technocratization of Public Education, detailing some of the history of the last century or so of very elite and well-connected families funding thinkers who want to shape the public education system. And you start out that article with a very specific discussion of a Gates Foundation-funded program called the Measures of Effective Teachers Project. So perhaps you can tell us about this project and its significance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Measures of Effective Teachers Project is part of a $45 million plan to quantify, to measure school teachers' alleged efficiency in delivering the public school curriculum. The project has a great many individuals involved, including academic psychologists, sociologists, education scholars, even a statistician from the RAND Corporation. The experiment began in 2009 and focuses mainly on inner-city schools. Now, the whole idea behind this is the establishment of a metrics for identifying techniques to maintain young people's attention spans. This looks to be, in part, a type of audience research, complete with galvanic skin bracelets to measure student behaviors and reactions. So the ostensible use of the data will be to determine how teachers will be hired, compensated, promoted, and so on. We have to be put on guard when we hear terms such as measurement or quantification, especially when it comes to education and teaching, because these were the techniques originally used to bring psychology into the American educational enterprise to begin with. The fact that this is being done to mainly African-American and Latino children in inner-city schools should also call to mind how early social science has been used to perpetuate eugenics and emphasize the alleged racially specific inferiorities of non-whites. So the project overall essentially involves the dehumanization of what is an inherently human process, that is, cultivating individuals to recognize and aspire to a higher intellectual level. The public school curriculum, the abundance of standardized testing, and now programs like these collectively act as a harness on real education. It's an attempt to refine the psychological conditioning and curriculum delivery process for a curriculum that is more or less dead on arrival and intended to discourage independent thought and curiosity.
Well, as you point out in this article, this specific project from the Gates Foundation is really only the latest and the most high-tech step in a century-long process that has been attempting to apply various psychological conditioning techniques in the public school system. So let's talk about those techniques in the American education system context. Who brought these techniques to the American public education system, and why did they do that?
Mm-hmm. There's a broad historical context for this that is rooted in European history and political thought that's largely been overlooked by most academics. This dates to at least the 17th century. However, if we are to locate a single individual and condition for the state of education today, we have to look to Wilhelm Wundt, who is the Prussian professor of psychology at the University of Leipzig in the late 19th century. When American higher education was in the process of being professionalized, most Americans who sought to obtain the professional academic degree, the Doctor of Philosophy, went to Germany to study. Now, ironically, a Doctor of Philosophy in Wundtian psychology was a PhD essentially devoid of any appreciation for or training in philosophy. Wundt developed what he termed experimental psychology, where the measurement and the recording of behavior or other observable phenomena was seen as necessary for knowledge production. In this framework, the human subject was recognized as devoid of any soul, will, or self-determination. Anything that could not be quantified was bracketed off and not worthy of consideration. The research subject, individuals or groups of individuals, came to be recognized as a stimulus response mechanism, and thus without will, they became docile and essentially dehumanized entities. So Wundt trains a great many American psychologists who returned from Germany and essentially established the field of psychology in the United States. They are largely behavioristic in their research approaches. For example, John Dewey is trained at Johns Hopkins by a student of Wundt's, G. Stanley Hall. Dewey and other Wundtians like James McKean Cattell, James Earl Russell, and Edward Thorndike go on to apply experimental psychological techniques to somewhat famously revise the educational practices at and found Columbia Teachers College at Columbia University. So with this, students come to be increasingly recognized as test subjects or stimulus response mechanisms. Wundt's disciples are especially influential because they have developed the psychological discipline, and they're at the leading institutions like Columbia, Johns Hopkins, and Chicago. These psychologists believed they were part of ushering in a new age. In many ways, they were. They sought to bring about a new being that would be more readily adapt to a socialist state, or what they termed the Great Society. This was a vision of progressive activists of the period for education specifically. The conditions and sentiment are similar in sociology, which in some way provides the basis for experimental psychology's application in educational settings. The sociologists Robert Park and Elbian Small had also been trained in Germany in the late 19th century and subsequently established the famous Chicago School of Sociology at the University of Chicago in the early 1900s. A specific conceptualization of society in German social scientists at the time is that society is a functioning organism akin to a biological entity. This was termed the organismic theory of society and is developed by German social theorist Albert Schaffel and the English sociologist Herbert Spencer in the late 1800s. Schaffel and Spencer exert a tremendous influence on early American sociology through the Chicago School. And Robert Park, it is fairly well known, uses the city of Chicago as a living laboratory to study various social phenomena. The first undergraduate sociology textbook, An Introduction to the Study of Society, is written by Small and George Vincent. And Vincent is the vice chancellor of the Chautauqua system of education. In this book, Small and Vincent discuss how the society is a psychophysical communicating apparatus, with the individual being a communicating and terminal cell in the social biological organism. In the view of the early American sociologists, a threat to the functioning of the collective organism is posed in the transition from community to society. There was a fear and a suspicion of the mob or the rabble, and a way of taming and disarming that threat was through educational practices employing the new psychology. If individuals can be deprived of their self-determination, they will be more efficiently managed cells and readily integrated constituents of the social organism, whether the organism be a city, a nation state, or a planetary population. There will be no cause for dissent if one is devoid of their individuality and will and are absorbed into the collective.
Well, and perhaps in a way you've kind of just answered this, but let's flesh that out a little. So from your research, why are rich families like the Rockefellers and the Gates, historically, why have they been funding these types of programs? What purpose do they serve for these types of people?
I think there are a number of reasons, and your listeners, and I think that some of the global research audience will be aware of these to at least some degree. U.S. tax laws beginning in 1913 under the Federal Reserve Act allow for wealthy families like the Rockefellers and the Carnegies to establish tax-free foundations where such families can dole out money to interests and projects they deem worthy. This allows them to steer much of the social and scientific research of academic, government, and private entities. The practice of philanthropy, made possible by such laws, has helped to salvage and prop up the public image of these families. John D. Rockefeller, for example, John D. Sr., regarded the $45 million donated to the founding of the University of Chicago as his greatest investment, because the public identifies education with scientific progress and social uplift. For the Rockefeller family, it was a public relations coup. The key for any philanthropic project is to make it look as if the money is somehow benefiting the public. This burnishes the image of the philanthropic entity in the public eye. If we look more closely at what types of projects are being funded and have been funded over the years, we can see how some of these powerful families are really much more concerned with things like social engineering. For example, you look at the millions of dollars that the Rockefeller Foundation puts into the green movement. Not only does it make that family look good, it also creates a semblance of a serious problem that can be used to shape social behavior and a host of related agendas. Another example is the Measure of Effective Teachers project of the Gates Foundation that we're discussing. It sounds nice on the surface, but this is a multi-million-dollar undertaking that transforms public school classrooms into psychological laboratories complete with human test subjects. And how will the information be used? Will the information be used to assist in helping to overcome resistance to vaccine programs in developing nations? Will it be used to program video games and so-called educational software? The public is told that the Gates want to help teaching in schools, but this in all likelihood, is a way to gain access to a particularly vulnerable group of human subjects and generate a wealth of data for future projects in social engineering. These wealthy individuals also live in a world apart from the rest of the Earth's population, both literally and figuratively. Once someone has incredible riches, they often develop the belief that they're a few steps above mere mortals and actually know what's best for the human race and the planet that we're on. If the population has been socially conditioned to be stimulus response mechanisms and behave like animals, if they've been trained in such a way as to overlook their self-determination, then it's especially convenient for these elites, or at least a portion of them, to regard the masses as nothing more than mere livestock. This is what spokespersons for wealthy interests such as Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann asserted back in the 1920s. That the public is dumb, that the public has an average IQ of about 100. The masses are driven by irrational drives. They're hopeless spectators. What figures such as Lippmann and Bernays don't say is that the public has to a large degree been made this way through mass education and mass media. This is really blaming the victims of propaganda and social psychological conditioning. So the public is increasingly thought of as superfluous, apart from its economic necessity as labor power. Again, if you consider the ideas of Ray Kurzweil, Nicholas Negroponte, or Bill Joy, and I know that you've discussed some of these on your program, for example, James, the global elites have their sights set years ahead of what we're taught to think about in news and popular culture. Their world is what is presented to us as science fiction. They have a vision that's much different from what the broader public has been taught to anticipate, I think.
Well, that is right, and I think that is the bigger picture here. But let's bring this back down to the day-to-day level. And these techniques have been increasingly applied over the course of the past century and presumably perfected over that time, or brought closer to perfection. So presumably, they are having an effect on the students themselves. And from your role as a college educator, you've had a chance to observe, I imagine, over the course of the years, how some of these techniques may have changed the students themselves. Have you noticed any changes in the aptitudes or the abilities of your students over the years as a result of these types of techniques?
Well, between being in graduate school and being on faculty, I've been teaching at the college level since 1996. So maybe if I went back 30 or 40 years, I might be able to detect something something greater than what I have detected. But nevertheless, I've taught about roughly 2,000 students in that period of time at three different state institutions. I've never encountered a student who's been incapable of serious thought. In many cases, they're just not used to being taken seriously or being challenged in the classroom, even at college, even at university. They've been put through the ringer of cookie-cutter curricula and standardized testing from kindergarten through high school, and often they can't write very well. And my theory is that they can't write very well because they don't read. And they don't read because a lot of the reading material that they've been exposed to in school just isn't very interesting, or it's nonsense. I recall that most of what I encountered as an undergraduate in college that really interested me, documentaries like the Panama Deception, this is going back 20 or more years, or journalism and media criticism from authors like Edward S. Herman or Project Censored, these were things I, for the most part, sought out on my own. I was almost never exposed to material like that by my professors. There were a few exceptions, but not very many. And so I'm inclined to think that that's generally the case today. And from that experience, what I attempt to do is to save students some time in their lives by pointing them in the right directions for news and for political analysis and for history as well. Because education is compulsory, and since its real function is to train and condition an obedient workforce, students identify intellectual activities with drudgery. One could make the argument that school instruction and curricula are designed to not only condition students into thinking of themselves as stimulus response mechanisms, but also to destroy their curiosity, which I think is even perhaps more important, especially toward social, political, and economic phenomena. I think the fashioning of students into stimulus response mechanisms contributes greatly to their depoliticization as well. If they by chance do become curious politically, that energy can be channeled into arguments corralled within the left-right framework or doing something like making their neighborhoods green. Most of my courses involve a good deal of reading and writing, yet students usually find the material worthwhile. The real challenge, I believe, is to rekindle their curiosity, because if a teacher can do that, then everything else falls into place. If you're in charge of choosing the books and other course content for the class, then recapturing that curiosity is quite easy to do. The biggest challenge for students is to synthesize ideas in an original fashion on paper and in discussion. And I encourage students to write on assigned readings and explain how the readings relate to other course content. And I mention that in part because many students have never really been asked to do this. Yet these are the active forms of literacy that they'll need to get through life. And it's what education is supposed to be all about. So usually they get the hang of it. This is also the case with essay exams, and I'm amazed to find that many students have seldom had an essay exam throughout most of their educational careers. Even at the college level, it's frequently multiple choice, short answer, true-false. And I think that today in public education, this is being made more difficult. Having a one-on-one with students and having a discussion and in a seminar sort of atmosphere or environment, which is what I attempt to shape, because our course caps are going up. And that's something that's fairly difficult to do when you have 40 or 50 students. Something you can do when you have like maybe 20 or 30 or so. So in the States anyway, students are paying more, and unfortunately they're getting less. And that's not the result of or the responsibility of the faculty, but rather of the administration. I'm not saying specifically to here. I think this is going on across the higher education.
Well, you've already addressed this to some extent, but let's talk a little bit more in specifics in terms of solutions to this. If students are being made more docile, more passive, less less capable of independent problem solving and reasoning through this process. What specifically can educators and students do to counteract that process and reintroduce that spark of curiosity?
Even if they were inclined towards being innovative, teachers have their hands tied if they can't determine the curriculum. So I believe that a lot of it begins at home. Parents should try to expose their children to as many experiences as possible, spend time reading with them and doing real things that don't involve computers and television. And if you do send your children to public school, try to become involved in the school somehow, or run for the school board so you might have some say in the curriculum. Teachers and homeschoolers need to ask themselves why there should be disciplinary silos instead of an all-inclusive curriculum that helps students understand relationships in the real world very early on. There's no need to separate these things, and this is largely an invention of academic institutions from the period that we were discussing earlier, the late 19th, early 20th centuries. Also, what types of communities are children involved in? How are they encouraged to make communities and form relationships? This could just begin in the neighborhood. Do they have an extended family like great aunts and uncles or grandparents around that can teach them the art of storytelling and the history of their family and their community? The sociologist Charles Horton Cooley developed the theory of the looking glass self to emphasize the importance of relationships like these in developing the individual. And unfortunately, too often, the relationships young people develop from an early age on are with fictitious characters they encounter on television or video games. Of course, these are poor substitutes for human relationships.
Indeed. Well, then finally, Dr. Tracy, wrapping things up, given your research into this subject and your experience in the classroom itself, are you ultimately optimistic or pessimistic that people will be able to overcome these conditioning techniques and really reignite that that curiosity and innovation?
Well, it's difficult to say. It depends on what level one wants to actually take that. I can't look beyond my classroom walls, really. I don't have any idea exactly what's going on in other, college classrooms or the like. I have an idea through my students, I'd be inclined to say I'm a bit pessimistic, unfortunately. I think things such as the internet do provide an avenue for finding good information, finding a wealth of information. But then again, one also has to be discerning with regard to the information itself. Where do you find it? Is it trustworthy? And so on and so forth. And these are some of the skills that I attempt to teach in my classes. And once again, as I was saying, gear students in the right direction for important and valuable information.
Well, on that very note, tell us about your website.
I began my website, my blog. I'm a bit skeptical with regard to technology, and I'm late in coming to the blogosphere. But I began a website back in March called memorygap.org, and I post an article up there every week or two, and I frequently send that also on to Global Research, and the material sometimes appears there. So it's great to be able to write for a larger audience than just an academic audience, and to kind of take some of the conversations that I start in the classroom and so forth, or with colleagues, to that larger audience and environment.
Well, I think that can only be for the good, so I hope people will check out memorygap.org. Dr. Tracy, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much.